This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 21 was recorded on June 30, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you this week. Grant Williams, Real Vision TV co-founder and publisher of the wildly popular Things That Make You Go Hmm newsletter, will be this week's feature interview guest. Grant and I will talk in depth about the Brexit referendum and what its likely fallout will mean to global markets. We'll also discuss contagion risks, both financial and geopolitical, and the ever-growing global addiction to debt and what it will eventually mean for asset markets.
And I'm Aaron Chan. In last week's show, Eric said he thought the people who were assuming a Remain vote was in the bag for the Brexit referendum were being overconfident. But based on tape action last Thursday afternoon, even UK Independence Party leader Nigel Farage said publicly that it appeared the Remain camp was likely to edge out a win. But then when the votes were counted, outright mayhem broke out in financial markets, with E-mini S&P futures trading limit down at one point during the overnight panic reaction. Since then, we've seen the S&P bottom at 1982, well, for now anyways, and the pound sterling bottom at 1.3127. Eric, before we move on to our usual market wrap, what's your take on Brexit in general and what it will mean to the global economy going forward?
Well, I was not at all surprised that the Brits voted to leave. Of course, I was caught off guard because the tape action last Thursday, as we reported on the show, seemed as though the Remain campaign had it in the bag. And of course, as I said on the show, I thought they were being overconfident and they were proven overconfident. What I was totally dumbfounded by, though, was David Cameron's resignation the next day. As I predicted last week on the program, I thought that if there was a vote to leave, that would result in the government announcing, hey guys, this is just a non-binding referendum. Parliament's going to take your desire to leave under consideration and under advisement as we, the government, decide what is in the country's best interest moving forward. We got the exact opposite, David Cameron stepping down the very next day. It was assumed that former London Mayor Boris Johnson was the heir apparent who almost was a shoo-in to take over the Prime Minister role. He, this morning, Thursday, said he wasn't interested. Seems like no savvy politician in Great Britain wants to be at the helm for whatever comes next. You know, if you're on a ship and the captain announces that he's going to quietly get on the lifeboat because he doesn't want to be captain anymore, and the first mate, whose whole career was spent hoping to be captain someday, says, actually, I think I'll pass. I'm going to get in the lifeboat with the captain. That sends a message that's pretty strong. So I think this is very, very important to global markets, but it's not imminently important. The reaction that we saw is exactly what you see when a war breaks out. Everybody says, oh my God, a war! Sell everything! And they get out of the market and there's a big crash, and the next day they actually stop and take a deep breath and think about it and say, a war. Oh, so that means dramatically increased government spending, increased demand for commodities. Oh, wait a minute. This is bullish. Let's get back in. In this case, it's the same phenomenon. But what's driving it is central bank expectations. Everybody said, oh my God, this is awful. Sell everything. Get out. And then, of course, when they stopped and thought about it, they said, wait a minute, just as bad as the new good when we get bad economic data and it results in stock markets being elevated because everybody expects that central banks are going to respond with easing, that's exactly what's driving this. And it was exacerbated today, Thursday, when Mark Carney from Bank of England said very clearly that the Bank of England would look for easing measures this summer. So it is a very important issue, but it is not something that's going to happen the next few days. It's going to happen over months and years. In my opinion, the big question is not what does this mean to Great Britain, but rather what does it mean for the European Union? Will this be the beginning of a mass exodus that eventually leads to the collapse of the European Union? I don't want to go too far into that because Grant Williams is going to have so much to say on it. I want to save it for the feature interview. I would say, though, things are heating up. There's an elitist named James Traub who penned an article in Foreign Policy this week. Now, that's not me editorializing, calling this guy an elitist. He describes himself as an elitist in the article. The title of his article is "It's Time for the Elites to Rise Up Against the Ignorant Masses." And he published this on the internet in Foreign Policy. A lesson to Mr. Trump, if he is listening. Sir, if your intention is to mute the opinion of the masses because you think that you are more qualified to decide what is best for them, I understand your perspective, but a little lesson in influence, sir. Do not call them ignorant masses on the internet. All it would take is your article going viral on the internet, and that by itself could infuriate what you call the ignorant masses so much that it results in a populist campaign that destroys the European Union. So, you know, we're really seeing the rhetoric getting dialed up in a major way here. I think that this is going to lead to dramatically increased volatility, both politically and in financial markets. The European Union will at first try to prevent this from happening. They'll try to punish and intimidate Great Britain by threatening not to have a trade agreement with them. The United States is not going to like that. That's going to result in political pressure, and there's going to be a whole lot of back and forth. The S&P just downgraded the European Union from AA+ to AA on Thursday afternoon. Again, let's save most of the Brexit discussion for Grant Williams' interview because he's got a lot to say, and I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. One of the things that we will mention in that interview, in your research roundup email, which was already sent to registered users at macrovoices.com. If you're not registered yet, you can register and find the links in our research library. There is a video with Raoul Paul and Grant Williams recorded this past Saturday in the immediate wake of the vote. And I think Raoul Paul has the single most prescient and intelligent thing that I've heard yet to say, and I'll summarize what Raoul said, is, look, if you want to know what this means, fade the pundits, fade the politicians, and let the markets tell you what it means. Because everybody is guessing right now. People who are opining about this, the talking heads on the financial networks, they don't know. They're guessing. We'll find out when the markets tell us what it means, and this is a time to let the markets speak. Remember that the guys on TV, it's very well known within that community that when you're guessing, which is what they're doing right now, it is best to take a very strong, high conviction opinion, because if you get lucky and get it right, you can play it for years, and if you get it wrong, nobody's going to blame you because a lot of people got it wrong. So the people who are speaking with authority and conviction that they're certain that they know what this means are bluffing. They're guessing like the rest of us.
Well, Eric, sounds like volatile times ahead. The S&P futures bottomed at 1982, but had retraced more than half the downside by Wednesday afternoon when the futures touched 2075 after the cash session closed. Then on Thursday this week, S&P futures traded as high as 2088. Eric, what's your outlook for equities?
Well, in the few moments that we've been recording this, Aaron, on Thursday afternoon, we hit 2091 and a quarter is the new high. So we're almost back to 2100, full retracement, and I think we're headed there. Generally, most technicians will tell you when you get past a 61.8% Fibonacci retracement, you're usually going to get all the way to 100. So that would suggest going back to the 2120 previous cycle high that we had seen. Why is this happening? Because more central bank easing is bullish. It means more accommodation, more easy money, and that easy money flows into asset markets. It does not mean that it's a good thing for the global economy. It's a very bad thing for the global economy. But just as we have other bad economic news result in higher stock prices because central banks have literally inverted the price signal, that's what we're seeing here. Also consider that for U.S. equities in particular, let's suppose this thing really gets ugly and it starts to look like the European Union could be at risk of collapsing. What does that mean? It means a huge amount of flight capital coming out of Europe and the rest of the world, and probably into the U.S. dollar and into U.S. asset markets. So there's a crack-up boom scenario where U.S. equity markets benefit tremendously because the rest of the world is starting to descend into an outright depression. Now, I'm not saying that that's going to happen. Again, nobody knows that yet. This could be the catalyst that leads to something big, but that something big could actually be bullish for U.S. equities because of the flight capital scenario.
Now, crude oil took a beating along with everything else on referendum night, but it seems to be recovering for the most part now. Eric, what's your outlook for crude?
Well, remember that the Brexit doesn't directly have anything to do with oil prices. The argument for why oil prices might go down in the wake of the Brexit would be if there is a global collapse in demand due to some kind of global financial Armageddon. Well, okay, this could lead to that. That's true. But the way it would lead to that is if there's a contagion and other countries leave the EU. This is something that would play out over months to years, not in the next, 2 days. So we saw a panic reaction. I think it was overblown. And consider, that could happen. We could have some really bad collapse of demand. But consider the situation in Venezuela, which produces 2.3 million barrels per day. Very significant. It's not quite Saudi Arabia, but it's a quarter the size of Saudi Arabia, a very large producer. The conditions in that country have devolved now to the point where literally nobody can get food other than people who have guns or huge amounts of money. People are literally killing their domestic pets and eating them for food. Things are that desperate. So far, there hasn't been any particular reduction in crude oil production, but that crude oil production is very much dependent on foreign service contractors, outside companies that Venezuela cannot produce their oil without the services of those outside contractors. It's estimated that as much as $2 billion with a B dollars of outstanding unpaid debt exists. So Venezuela is not paying its bills. The service providers are continuing to service them because they want the revenue. But at some point, when you've got a customer who won't pay, you give up on them and you give up on collecting that debt, write it off, and move on. If we get to the point where the oil service companies give up on Venezuela, that could take 2.5 million barrels offline, and that would be a bigger effect than any demand collapse that might be a result of Brexit. So what got us back to $50 this week? Well, I think the main thing was the drawdown on national inventories reported by the Department of Energy this week. 4 million barrel drawdown on national crude oil inventory. That's a big drawdown for sure. But frankly, it's pretty normal for this time of year. We're right smack dab in the middle of summer driving season, when you would expect that size of drawdown. Remember, as we discussed last week, you would need 12 million barrels per week of drawdowns in order to get back to historical norms in terms of storage capacity by Labor Day. Now, we don't have to get back to historical norms, but we're still at a very stressed situation. The thing that was really distressing to me, though, and the market first reacted to it, then went the other way, is gasoline build on inventory. Think about it. We're right smack in the middle of summer driving season, and there's a 1.4 million barrel build on inventory. Gasoline is not selling at the pace that it was expected to. That is a major red flag, and it's a proxy for what the American consumer may be thinking. Now, that was offset by a larger drawdown of 1.8 million barrels of distillates. Distillates, again, are things like diesel fuel and jet fuel. But the thing is, those are things like diesel fuel and jet fuel. They are consumed out of necessity. The gasoline is a much better proxy for discretionary spending by the U.S. consumer, and that's where we're seeing an unexpected build. A 950,000 barrel drawdown on Cushing, Oklahoma inventory is refreshing because it gives us a little bit more storage capacity, down to about 88% of capacity right now. Now, it's interesting that when we were looking at 97% of capacity, we only had about a 50-cent front-month contango. Remember that that difference between the front-month futures contract price and the second month is effectively a proxy for what the market is willing to pay for storage of oil over that month, if there's excess oil that needs to be stored. Well, we were showing about a 50-cent contango this time a month ago, and it touched 74 cents yesterday, and 68 cents was the last trade. It just popped to 69 as I was glancing at my monitor here. So that's dramatically wider for this time of month than it was last month, even though we have more storage capacity. How's that possible? Well, I think the reason is the markets are forward-looking. And, Labor Day is not here yet, but it's coming. We're only a couple of months away from that consumption being over. Really, from a refining standpoint, only about 1 month away from it being over. And we haven't seen the kind of drawdowns on inventory that we should have seen by now. So we could be just as we feared, everybody thought that the big risk was this spring, we might have had a storage crisis. People assumed that by fall, the market will have rebalanced itself. It's looking like maybe we could be facing a storage crisis in the fall and lower oil prices as a result. Looks like there may be a strike starting in Norway on Saturday that could close in about 300,000 barrels per day. But also the Niger Delta Avengers apparently coming to a truce deal with the Nigerian government. And then the Canadian wildfire situation, almost under control, not completely under control. Those factors came together to lead Goldman Sachs to issue a note saying that they now see downside risk to their $50 forecast for the second half. So there's a lot of factors in play. But in general, I don't think that the Brexit is as big a deal for oil prices as a lot of people thought it would be.
So Eric, you opined last week that gold would likely see the biggest upside pop in the event of a Brexit leave result, because it had the least liquidity to absorb large flows of flight capital. Just a few hours after you made that prediction, the yellow metal spiked more than $100 over the course of just a couple of hours as the leave votes kept pouring in, finally testing 1362 before it was all over. Since then, it's traded as low as 1308, and as we're recording Thursday afternoon, we're looking at 1322. What's your outlook for gold?
Well, and it's actually up to 1326 since we started taping the show. I do think that the strength that we're seeing is clearly a result of the Brexit referendum. But look at other markets. The S&P was down really hard, and it's almost fully retraced. So the question remains to be seen is, will CPM Group's prediction, which was that after the excitement was over, that you would see gold sell off again, is that going to play out? Or are we going to get more threats of euro exit contagion, other countries threatening to also leave, potentially adding to the concern and causing gold to move higher? Well, we've yet to see what happens, but remember, something that we could see happen here is the Fed, the U.S. Federal Reserve, might use Brexit as the excuse for a policy U-turn. Now, if the Fed abandons their rate hiking cycle and formally announces that it's over and they're moving back towards more of an accommodation or easing stance, that definitely could move gold much higher. I was particularly interested by Raoul Paul's comment in that interview that we mentioned earlier. Again, there's a link to it in your Research Roundup email, saying that we're finally seeing both gold and the dollar index moving higher together. That, to me, suggests an opportunity for a pairs trade. If you go long the dollar index and long gold futures at the same time, well, you better believe that there is downside risk in gold. CPM Group could be right about gold, but if CPM Group is right about gold, it means the dollar index is probably headed higher. So you've got an effective hedge there. If Raoul Paul is right, and both of them move higher, then you've got a double win situation. I can't really think of a scenario where gold collapses in price and the dollar index collapses in price. Dollar could definitely go down. There's scenarios for that. But dollar and gold going down together, I don't really see that on the horizon.
And speaking of the DXY, what do you see on the horizon for the dollar in the wake of the leave vote?
Well, it's a huge question mark, and the reason I say that is clearly, without a doubt, the capital inflows are into the dollar. That's why we're seeing so much dollar strength in the last few days in the wake of the referendum. But wait a minute. Remember that what could happen here is this may become the U.S. Federal Reserve's excuse for a policy U-turn. If the Fed abandons their rate hiking cycle, and especially if they start talking explicitly about easing into either negative interest rates or even QE4, that is definitely not going to help the dollar index. So on the other hand, the reason that they might be doing that is because of all these other fundamental factors that would be helping the dollar index. Which one's going to win out in terms of that tipping scale? I don't think anybody knows. As Raoul Paul said, we're going to have to let the markets tell us. But again, consider that pairs trade, long the dollar index, long gold futures. I don't necessarily think that both of them are going to win, but it's hard for me to see both of them losing.
3 weeks ago, you said 1.7% could be a credibility level for the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield, below which you thought it would be hard for the Fed to justify continuing their rate hiking schedule. We've seen it fall almost as low as 1.5% on pre-Brexit fears, then recover to 1.73 a week ago when everyone seemed to be betting that a Remain vote was in the bag. But since the Brexit surprise, it's traded down to the low 140s, but barely above the all-time 1.39 record closing low from 2012. What is a 10-year yield telling you this week?
I think it's too early to tell. Without a doubt, the big sell-off all the way down, I think it hit 142 or something at one point. That was all about massive panic flight capital. It was very much coincident with the opposite move in the pound sterling. You know, as everybody is freaking out over the Brexit, money is coming out of the pound sterling into the dollar and into U.S. treasuries, pushing the yield down. So that super low number, almost touching the record low from 2012, it was a panic knee-jerk reaction. As we're recording the show now on Thursday afternoon, we're back to 1.48, almost back to the 150 level that we were at prior to the Brexit. The question is, do we continue to recover? If we get back above 1.7, then I think the Fed can breathe a sigh of relief. But if these events that occur as a result of Brexit, and particularly if more contagion fears take over of other countries leaving the euro, and we get below that 1.39 number, then I think that we're in for a whole different ballgame. So we really have to wait and see as to whether or not this is going to blow over or not. Looks like U.S. equities and European equities are the first place that things have blown over. Are we going to see it blow over in the 10-year yield? They haven't yet, but I think that we're headed in the right direction, at least so far.
Great. Thanks for the market update, Eric. So this week's featured guest is a Macro Voices legend. Grant Williams publishes the Things That Make You Go, newsletter, and is also co-founder of Real Vision Television. When Eric interviewed Grant in Macro Voices Episode 5 back in early March, the download demand was so extreme that it literally crippled our server at one point. The server has since been upgraded and bandwidth increased, and our webmaster has taken special precautions to prepare for Grant's return. So without further ado, Eric's interview with Grant Williams is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next is Grant Williams from Things That Make You Go Hmm and Real Vision Television. Grant, two things that you and I share in common. Number one, we both follow macroeconomics. But number two, we have both lived for several years outside of our country of birth. And I don't want to speak for you, but I know that in my case, this has given me a completely different view of my own country's politics and events that go on. Just because I see it through a more objective lens, I'm not there to get caught up in whether Donald Trump said something racist or not racist. I can more easily step back and see the big picture of, holy cow, my country has never been in a situation before where nobody's voting for anything. They're all voting against something. So I'd like to start with your experience watching the lead up to this Brexit event in your country, Great Britain, as you have lived outside of Britain for a long time. What was your experience? What do you think? How are your countrymen handling this in terms of the balance between emotion and objectivity?
Well, Eric, I don't think there's any balance. There was no balance whatsoever. You know, this became it's a very impassioned debate, and so I think both sides recognized that very early on, and they just inflamed those passions, thinking it was going to be passion that would get people out. It was going to be passion that would get people to vote, and sure enough, they succeeded. But obviously, when you inflame passions, you tend to get people, by definition, voting with their hearts and not necessarily their heads. And so, you know, to me, I wrote the piece in February saying that I thought that the Brits would vote to leave. At the time, it was very non-consensus, and even right up to the when the vote started coming, it was non-consensus. But Britain has always had a very peculiar relationship with Europe. You know, the Brits are proud to be part of Europe, but they're not necessarily proud Europeans. And I mean that in the sense of what Europe has become. The origins of the project were sound. They were well-intentioned, but it's become this stifling bureaucracy that has taken a lot of governance away from the nation states. And the most interesting part of what happened in the lead-up was how much was made of this being all about immigration and racism. And I think today, I don't think there's any more powerful word in the world than racist or racism, because once you throw that at someone or something or a cause or an idea, it tends to stick, and it stops people looking beyond it because they don't want to be tainted with it. They don't want to be associated with it. And so that was essentially Project Fear tried to make it all about immigration. And there is a mathematical component to the immigration argument, which is just the strain on services. But that was drowned out in the kind of, you know, no immigrants over here. And the UK has always been an incredibly multicultural society, and it's been the better off for that. So I think the Remain campaign tried to make this about immigration, and it kind of backfired on them. So to your point about being overseas, yes, it's given me a much clearer perspective of the issues in the build-up to the election, as I'm sure you have of what's happening in the US right now. And it's the fallout now that we have to deal with, because whatever happened in the lead-up is done, it's finished, the referendum's been held, and the result decided. So now it all becomes about what happens next. And the thing that surprised me the most, and you know, Raoul and I chatted about this last week, was the lack of any plan on the part of really anybody, because I think the Remainers expected to leave, so didn't think they needed a plan, and the Brexiters probably didn't think they'd win, and so they didn't really have a plan. So here we are in this vacuum, a political vacuum, it looks like an economic vacuum. And of course, into that step, a lot of people, everyone's got an opinion on this, and a lot of those opinions are, again, constructed in haste, and I think cooler heads will ultimately prevail. And the markets are telling us that. You know, we saw in the immediate aftermath, the commentary was, you know, this is the end of the world, it's going to shake the global system to its foundations, all the stuff we've heard a thousand times before. And yet, the day after Brexit, on the Friday, the FTSE closed up 2.5% week on week. Okay, it was down. Sterling had its biggest fall. The headlines were that Sterling had its biggest fall since 1985. The other headline could have been Sterling closes 1.8% below where it closed in February. And the fact that it fell 10% today is, yes, it's a massive move in a currency, but no one spoke about the 7.5% run-up going into the election when people were convinced that the Remainers were going to win. So there's been a lot of hyperbole around this, a lot of inflamed passions, as I said, but now it becomes a question of sitting down and working out what next.
And what is your own view about what's best long-term for Great Britain? Because obviously a lot of people see very good reasons that it might be in Britain's interest not to be part of the European Union. But, you know, the process of getting out is going to be painful for sure. So what's your own view, having had the opportunity to see this objectively from afar?
Well, it's interesting you say that. We don't know what the process is going to be getting out because no one's done it before. And so there are two ways this can go in my view. One is that you get a bunch of adults in a room sitting down discussing how to make the best of this and how to come up with a deal that works for everybody. If that happens, I think it would. It's not going to be a cakewalk, but I think there is a clear path to a good deal to be done that will impact people in Europe to the minimal amount possible. However, the other path, which is, I suspect, far more likely, is that you have a group of very angry European politicians, the likes of Jean-Claude Juncker, who I'm no fan of, and that's well documented over the years, but just to see his reaction tells you that having the UK pull the rug out from under this grand project of theirs is not going to make them conducive to a friendly and sensible negotiation. So I think it's going to be bitter. I think the Eurocrats are going to try and really make an example of the UK because they don't want other people to leave. However, the bigger issue here is I think that die is now cast. I think whatever happens now, when we look back on this in 5 years' time, maybe 10 years' time, I don't know how long they're going to drag this thing on, but I think you will be able to point back clearly and say that the day that the Brits voted to leave the EU was the day that the EU began to fall apart. And it may come back in another form, which would be great. But I think as it is now, its current design doesn't work. It's inherently flawed. And this is going to be the first in a series of dominoes that ends up with there being no more EU, certainly not in its current shape.
I was not surprised by the vote, other than the market was predicting the opposite. So I was surprised that so many people got the exit poll wrong. A lot of hedge funds had commissioned private exit polls and so forth. But the fact that Brits chose to leave did not surprise me. But my prediction, in fact, 1 week ago today on this program, was that Mr. Cameron would come out swinging, that he would immediately say, well, the Parliament will take this under advisement, but this was a non-binding referendum and the government will decide the best thing. He resigned the next day. I was completely floored by that, and a lot of the people in his own party were very offended and upset. They were trying to push for a second referendum. It was Mr. Cameron who said no to that. And the critics of Mr. Cameron and his own party said, look, you're effectively handing the prime minister position to Boris Johnson by doing this. And then this morning, Boris Johnson announces he doesn't want it. What is going on? I completely do not understand the politics in your country, sir.
Well, I said the man who has a choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in November. It's politics, so it's complicated. There's a lot more to it. Nothing is what it seems on the surface. But first of all, to address the question of a second referendum. I mean, it was a nonsensical idea. You don't get do-overs in these things. Incidentally, the interesting thing being that a couple of European nations that voted no to the Lisbon Treaty, those referendums were overruled by the EU, and they put the Lisbon Treaty in through the back door. But leaving that aside, I don't think there was ever going to be another referendum, because I think at some level, you know, Brits are very proud of their democracy. They're proud of the way the country works, the rule of law, etc. And I think had they tried to run another referendum, despite all the clamouring on the part of the Remainers, who said, well, you know, I would have come out and voted if I'd known we were going to lose. I think if you actually tried to turn over a result that 53% of the population wanted, you would only energise the Brexiters to come out in more force. And you'd get the people that were kind of on the fence thinking, you know, this just isn't fair. So I think they ran the risk of losing again if they had run a second referendum. So it's done, it's over, it's what happens next now. And I think there will be an attempt to maybe not invoke Article 50. They'll drag this thing out. There's a lot of talk going on. You know, Merkel wants it done slowly. Juncker wants it done quickly. David Cameron doesn't seem to want to do anything. And we just won't know. We just won't know how this is going to play out, because, as I said at the beginning, no one had a plan. But it's a reality at some point they have to deal with. Now, with regards to the domestic political situation in the UK, I think Cameron resigning the morning after, to me, I thought that was somewhat cowardly. I thought, you called the referendum, you said you'd give it to the people, you're really obligated to then carry out what they've asked you to do. So to step down because you lost seemed somewhat petulant to me. So I was disappointed that he did that. With regards to Boris Johnson, you know, I think everyone had assumed he was a shoo-in, and that was really more for his charisma than his political ability, maybe. And I think Michael Gove announcing that he was going to stand this morning, who is a much more cutthroat politician, he's much more Frank Underwood than Boris Johnson is. And whether Boris just figures it's not a fight he wants to get into, it's not a place he wants to go and get down into the dirty side of politics, I don't know. I mean, Boris has his reasons, I'm sure. But it's interesting to see a true, almost Machiavellian politician come through this at the end and look to consolidate power. So it remains to be seen which way this goes. It's going to be fascinating to watch. As you said, you know, Boris only resigned this morning, so we're still, I mean, the English political establishment is still shaking from that. So we have to wait till at least stop reverberating before we can make a choice. But I think, to me, it certainly improves the chances of Dr. Liam Fox, who we were fortunate enough to interview on Real Vision a little while ago. And he's a very thoughtful man with, I think, the right credentials for the job. But it remains to be seen. It's going to be a fascinating thing to watch.
Now, as we start to look to financial markets, of course, markets don't like uncertainty. And first of all, if Article 50 were to be invoked, it's completely uncertain what it means, because nobody's ever done it before. We don't know whether Article 50 will be invoked. And meanwhile, both Scotland and Northern Ireland are beginning to make noises about possible recession and not participating in the Brexit and staying in the EU as independent countries. So that's another uncertainty. How do you assess what all this is going to mean for both the pound sterling and for other British markets as we go through this period of uncertainty as we figure out what's next?
Well, I think the markets have shown you that there's one piece of certainty, certainly to the market's point of view, that the market is counting on, and that is there will be yet more coordinated central bank action to stem any volatility in the markets. And that's what they seem to be telling you with this bounce we've seen. Again, it's not going to make itself clear for a little while what's going to happen here, but if you look back to the end of QE3, when everyone was predicting the end of the world, and it kind of passed without too much volatility, and everybody looked at it and said, hey, you know what, we got away with that, this is great. Here we are a couple of years later. When you look back, you can see that at that point, markets change, and they stop going up, and the S&P has gone sideways for the best part of 2 years. And so things did change, and we're going to be able to look back on this, and once the volatility has calmed down, and look in a set of cold, hard charts that tell us, and I suspect we are going to see several things. We will see the pound weaker. We very well might see a UK recession. The big problem perhaps is the strength in the yen. That's certainly unwanted by Messrs. Abe and Kuroda and arguably the wider world, and that will have knock-on effects. It will probably send the dollar stronger, which again causes problems for a lot of people around the world. There are going to be all kinds of fallouts from this, but I think what's going to be interesting to watch is not so much the UK, but Europe. And if you look at how various markets acted the day after Brexit, the UK was down, 3.5%. This is in local currency terms. But European bourses were down 9%. And the big standouts were the Italian, particularly Italian, and the Spanish banking sectors. And we get back to the point where we've been all along, and that is the problems at the heart of the banking sector. The UK is one of the biggest contributors to the EU and therefore to any bailout. They've walked away. And so suddenly the things that were ring-fenced, the things that were protected, like the Italian banking system, are under pressure again. And these are the places you need to look for the knock-on effects of the Brexit decision. It's not necessarily in the UK. I think if you look at the export numbers, you look at the balance of trade in many places, particularly with Germany, the UK is a net importer of German goods. I forget the numbers, but it's something like £56 billion a year. It's going to be a major problem for Germany if they don't have a decent trade agreement with with the UK. So it's not about the pound, it's not about the FTSE, it's about the knock-on effects. And they are going to happen all over the place. A lot of that will be due to nervousness, a lot of that will be due to uncertainty. But over the next couple of weeks and couple of months, it's going to become clear where the fault lines are. And I suspect that the major ones are going to be the yen, arguably the dollar, and particularly the European banking system.
Speaking of the European banking system, we're speaking now on Thursday mid-afternoon European time. Deutsche Bank is down another 4% just today, approaching another low. Is Deutsche Bank the canary in the coal mine, or potentially the next Lehman that's going to fall and start a major contagion risk across Europe?
Well, look, one thing I can pretty much guarantee is that it won't fall, because it can't be allowed to fall. You talk about too big to fail. Deutsche Bank is the poster child for that. But it's also got an enormous balance sheet in the multiple trillions of dollars. It's a clear problem at the heart of the European banking sector. And, of course, everything that's been done, bizarrely, to ring-fence these banks and all the buying of sovereign bonds, all the buying of corporate debt, everything that's been done, when you ally that with negative interest rates, you basically end up with a group of banks that don't have any net interest margin. They can't really make any money in a traditional way. You've handicapped them from being able to trade. So there's no real way for these banks to make any money. I think people realize that. It's not just Deutsche Bank. Look at UBS, look at Credit Suisse. I mean, these were titans of the European banking system, and the charts are broken. I mean, the companies are on their knees. They all look, from a charting perspective, like they're going to zero. So what the EU are going to do when this becomes a bigger problem Well, it's not beyond me, because they will end up maybe just taking all these things onto the public balance sheet. They're going to have to do something of that magnitude to stem the possible contagion from a failure in something like Deutsche Bank. It is way, way, way too big to fail.
And aside from the financial contagion, I suppose there's also the political or exit contagion risk here, which is that the decision by Britain may lead to a number of other countries having their own referenda for exiting the EU. Do you see that as likely? And I would think that would just lead to tremendous infighting where the EU perceives an existential threat and has to do something to make a really bad example of Britain in order to stem other countries from leaving. Is that a risk?
I think it's more than risk. I think it's a certainty. I mean, it's happening already. The calls for referenda across Europe are growing louder every day. And if you look at the approval ratings throughout the European continent, the mainland European continent, you'll see that the approval ratings for Brussels are actually lower in France and in Holland and in Austria than they actually were in the UK. So, there will be more referenda. Without any shadow of a doubt in my mind, it's really going to depend. And we may have one in Greece coming up, another one in Greece coming up fairly shortly, although that last one seemed to pass with a no vote and nothing actually happened. But this is not going to change until Brussels changed. This disaffection with what the European project has become, I think, is totally justified, and I think is not going to change unless the EU reforms. And it is as bloated an institution as you can possibly imagine. I don't know if people know this, but the entire European Parliament picks up and alternates between Brussels and Strasbourg. Everybody in that operation gets up and moves all the documents, all the people from one city to the other every, I forget how often it is, but it's several times a year just because they couldn't decide, which place to have the base. And it's farcical. The cost of that alone is in the hundreds of millions, if not the billions every year, I don't know. But there are so many ridiculous aspects of the EU that are just going to get magnified as this disaffection grows and sweeps across the continent. So if you want to get people angry at the European Union who already aren't, there are plenty of things you can point them towards that are just going to make them go, you've got to be kidding me. So they're going to have to do something with this, because this grand dream of theirs is crumbling before their eyes. And I think their natural answer, as you quite rightly pointed out, Eric, is that they will try and make an example of the UK, because that's their way. Instead of conceding and conciliating and trying to change things, they will want to make an example and punish Britain. And I think, once again, that will backfire on them horribly, and people will see the punishment, and rather than be afraid to leave, it will reinforce any view they had of the EU as an overbearing institution with perhaps more power than it should have.
Moving beyond Europe to the effects on the rest of the global economy, do you think that the Brexit event and the aftermath will become the excuse for the U.S. Federal Reserve to make a policy U-turn and abandon their rate tightening cycle and maybe move back towards either negative rates or even QE4?
Look, it'll be one of them, I'm sure. Look, it already is. I mean, they at the April meeting, they said then that a possible Brexit vote might be enough to keep the Fed on hold at the June meeting, which, as I pointed out in a recent presentation I did, made me laugh, because the Brexit vote was the 23rd and the Fed meeting was the 15th. So, they were going to use something that might or might not happen in a week's time to keep rates on hold. And bear in mind that at the time of the Fed meeting was when the Remain camp was at their strongest, and the sentiment was overwhelming that it was going to be a landslide for Remain, and they still kept rates on hold. I've been saying for a long time now there's no way the Fed were going to get their four hikes. I thought they were lucky to get one away, and they did it at the wrong time for the wrong reasons. And I think everything I've seen tells me they absolutely know that. The data is telling them the economy is not strong, and more worryingly for them, the data is starting to tell the public and the markets that the economy is not as strong as they've been saying it is. And the old saying about, generally speaking, hope is not an investment strategy, has certainly been proven to be right where the Fed is concerned. I don't think there's any way they can raise. I think they will be forced to cut again. They will be forced into jawboning. All the things they've done previously, only this time they're starting off at 25 basis points on the Fed funds rate. And so they don't really have anywhere to go but QE and potentially negative rates. And I think again, that's baked in the cake that that's the way this is going.
You and your partner, Raul Paul, made a video about the Brexit aftermath this past weekend. And incidentally, for our registered users at macrovoices.com, your research roundup email will contain a link to that. That one is free in the clear. You don't have to be a subscriber to Real Vision in order to watch it. One of the things I found most interesting in that video was, I think it was Raul who made the observation that this is the first time in a long time that we've seen the U.S. dollar index and gold move in the same direction, both up at the same time. And as I started thinking about that after watching the video, it occurred to me there's maybe a really good setup for a pairs trade here, long the dollar index and long gold at the same time, because although normally those would act opposite, if the thesis proves wrong, one hedges the other and you break even. If the thesis that Raul asserted in that video proves right, then it's a double win. Any reaction to that?
Yeah, this is something that again, you know, I talk a lot about gold and have done for the last few years, and this was always, to me, going to be a sign that we were approaching the end game, was when the dollar and gold both went up at the same time. So it was something that I was looking for, maybe not expecting so much as potentially hoping for and certainly looking for, and it's starting to happen. I don't think it's a one-way ticket from here. I think I don't know that they're now going to be trading in lockstep, but it's a sign to me that people are starting to look for safe haven assets. And you know, as we know, what used to be safe haven assets in government bonds are not that anymore, because you've got instruments that can very, very easily give you tremendous capital losses. And so sovereign bonds are not the flight to safety assets they once were. The dollar currently is, when you look around the world, bizarrely the yen is, and of course gold is. And so people make the assumption that it's impossible for gold and the dollar to go up at the same time, and that's a very false assumption to make. I mean, in times of great stress, they absolutely do that. You know, we saw it in the 30s, we saw it in 08, and we'll see it again when this next crisis plays out. And another crisis is coming. I mean, it's not fear-mongering, It's really just a pragmatic look at a world which has been trying to stave off that crisis for 8 years now, singularly unsuccessfully, and in doing so has really magnified the problem, which is the debt burden. So, you know, something is coming, and people need to understand that and start thinking about how to prepare for it. And if you're going to do that, then cash in the form of the dollar and gold are two sensible ways to do that. And I think what you're seeing is more and more people perhaps coming to that understanding, looking at the economic data at the US and realizing, okay, you know, it is time to be cautious, it's time to play defense, it's time to have cash, it's time to have gold. And I think you're seeing that play out.
When we step back and really look at the big picture of what's going on in the world, you know, I see, of course, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen next as a result of this referendum. But I think you and I agree that perhaps the European Union's days are numbered, or years are numbered, perhaps is a better way of saying it. I don't think it's imminent, but it's. I agree with you that if there's an event people will look back to as to what the beginning of the end was, it will probably be this referendum. But we've already got China's economy on the rocks. Australia's economy is very dependent on exports to China. Japan's fiscal and monetary situation is just a total chaos. And we've got more and more aggression in the world. We've got more terrorism and unrest events, mass shootings in the United States. It just feels to me like we're getting in this fourth turning context in the Kondratiev wave to a really scary time over the next 10 years. Would you agree with that? Do you think that there is a war risk as a result of potentially the EU collapsing if, as you say, they try to make an example of Britain and that just infuriates people more and there's a sudden rush to abandon the EU? Where could all of this take us geopolitically?
Well, look, if you look at history, which is something I love to do, you will see that this ends in war. This is what these kinds of times end in war. Not always, but often enough to make you have to be aware that it's a very real possibility. And it sounds crazy talking about this in this day and age, But if you look at, I did a presentation in the beginning of 2015 when I talked about the parallels between 1914, the lead up to World War One, and the current state of the world. And the parallels are eerie. I mean, it's really quite frightening. It was called the consequences of the economic peace. I think if you Google it, you'll be able to find it on YouTube. But it's scary. But it's just history rhyming. It doesn't repeat, as the old quote says. It rhymes. And when you look at the situation in the world, so you look at the debt, you look at the political upheaval, you look at the potential societal upheaval. So many times, going back through history, that has ended up in war. Now, we all hope that it won't happen, and it's not, absolutely not, any kind of base case. But people tend to discount it as an outcome. And my point back then, and I think that point has been reinforced by everything that's happened in the sort of 18 months since I gave that presentation, is that the possibility is not zero. And that's the important thing to realize. When I first gave the speech, the first question I had from a member of the audience was, so are you saying there's going to be another war? And I chose my words very carefully, but what I said is, I'm not saying there's going to be a war. What I'm saying is there's not going to be another war. And it sounds like I'm almost being cute, but I'm absolutely not. I think it's very important to understand that whatever the chance of there being some kind of conflict, it's absolutely not zero. And so anytime there's a greater than zero chance of an outcome, you at least need to think about it. How could it happen? What would it mean? And what should I do about it? And there's a point where, as that probability increases, where you actively have to take steps to mitigate it on a personal basis in terms of your investments. And we're not there yet, but it needs to be in people's understanding that miscalculations get made. Accidents happen, people overstep the mark, your politicians want to make great strides. These things happen, and they happen in times of stress, and we are at a time of critical stress right now, and so that just increases the probability of bad outcomes.
Well, unfortunately, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm very concerned about the war risk in coming years, and especially, as you said, we're down to Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton in the United States, and I don't think either one of them are pacifists, unfortunately.
Well, I agree with that, Eric. Just to add, from what you see of Trump, for example, I'd like to go on the record as I'm firmly not endorsing Donald Trump, but he's more of an isolationist, and he wants to kind of withdraw England. I think his warmongering aims are potentially, well, not warmongering, but the likelihood of him getting into war is potentially lower than that of, say, Hillary Clinton, who again, I'm not choosing one over the other, but I could see a path to an accidental conflict far more clearly if Hillary were in charge than Trump, who I think just wants to pull his horns in and bring America more inside its own borders.
Well, I agree with that. I think Hillary is more likely to start a war. I'm afraid that Mr. Trump's trade policies with China might provoke aggression from outside. So I think it would start differently.
Yep.
But I don't think either one of them is going to, well, I won't say they won't get a Nobel Peace Prize, because we know now that American presidents who don't deserve them can get Nobel Peace Prizes. But I don't think either one of them will earn one. Why don't we move on to a slightly more pleasant topic, which is the crisis of debt around the world. In addition to the video that I already mentioned, which is in your Research Roundup email, you recently produced another video called Crazy, and very aptly titled, talking about the debt situation that we face. Real Vision subscribers can get that already. It is not yet available out to non-subscribers. We are negotiating with your office to get our subscribers a link, which will be in next week's Research Roundup email. We'll also tweet it as soon as we get it, hopefully early next week. Give our listeners a sense of what this video is about so they know what to expect there.
Well, I love the idea that you and I can segue from war into a slightly more pleasant topic, which is the enormous mountain of debt hanging over the world. This has now become a more pleasant topic, which speaks volumes, I think, Eric, for what's going on. But the presentation was something I put together last month, and it's just an attempt to show the staggering amount of debt in the world. I focus on Japan. I focus on the reality of the U.S. economy, and try and walk people through how a group of unelected officials in the shape of central bankers, going back to Alan Greenspan, have created this almost parallel universe that we live in, with just crazy things like negative interest rates. I mean, which if you'd spoken to anyone about that in the 1980s, for example, suggested that there was even a chance that interest rates would go negative, they would have put you in an asylum. And yet here we are. And because of the way this has happened, we now find ourselves, as I pointed out in the presentation, where you literally wake up one morning to find that almost a quarter of world GDP is being produced in countries that have negative interest rates. And you just have to say, how did this happen? How did we get to this point? And we got to this point through a series of, at the time, seemingly small steps, but all of which were designed to head off the latest problem. There's been no proactive policy for, well, I don't know, probably since for at least 20 years. And everything that's been done has been a reaction to the latest crisis, and it's generally been in the form of lowering interest rates and flooding the markets with liquidity, which has led to extraordinary increases in asset prices, which is fine for the people who own those assets. But when you reach the bounds of that, which is, I'm afraid, where we are now, something has to give. And that's, brings us back to everything we've been talking about, this, the pressure for the natural forces to reassert themselves is becoming overwhelming for these guys to fight. And they, they've run out of arrows in their quiver now. There is going to be a denouement. It's not going to be pretty. The question is, when's it going to happen? And obviously, that's the answer none of us have. But I suspect the day it does happen is drawing closer. So the presentation was just an attempt to point out the madness that got us here, point out where we are, and suggest a couple of ideas that you and I have discussed here: owning some gold for the short term, owning some U.S. Treasuries, owning the dollar in a flight to safety are going to be things people, I suspect, are going to wish they'd done when this thing plays out.
Well, I cannot strongly enough recommend to our listeners that they watch this one because, frankly, I follow this stuff very carefully. I think I knew most of the facts in this video, but just the way you pulled them all together into one concise presentation was so effective. I really enjoyed it, and I'm sure that our listeners will enjoy it as well. But I do want to push back on one point, which is the idea that it's close to all falling apart, because in the summer of 2009, after QE1 was announced, I very boldly and very wrongly predicted this is never going to work. And the reason I said it's never going to work is they're not addressing any real problem. We're not solving any root cause problem. The 2008 event was caused entirely by too much debt, and the government reaction was to create more debt. And I said, the market's going to see through this. The rally won't last. Well, of course, that's not what happened. The equity values tripled since then. So I guess what I have to wonder is, you say they don't have any more arrows in their quiver. At some point, I could easily see this leading to a major war event as everybody bails out of the EU and the other things that we talked about. But until then, it seems to me that they can go back to more quantitative easing. I think at some point, if we got runaway inflation, that would lock their hands and they wouldn't be able to respond accommodatively as they have so far. But despite the face of this just overwhelmingly compelling argument that you make about too much debt, what's to stop them from just printing a few trillion more and boosting asset prices for another few years?
I think the difference here is that when they started QE1, they were in the depths of what was the biggest recession since the 1930s. Arguably, it was a depression, certainly a depression across southern Europe. The US avoided it with a sharp bounce because of QE. But now, if they try and do this again, it's not going to stop the US falling into recession, I don't think, because when you look at 70% of the US economy being the consumer, and you look at the increase in savings rate, the increase in credit stress on consumers, there is a problem somewhere in the consumer. He's not spending the money he was. He's not borrowing the money he was. He's not earning any more than he was. And so the US, I think, if it's not already in a recession, will go into a recession. And I don't think that that is something that can be staved off with spending trillions of dollars on buying bonds that already yield negative. I just don't see, until we get a turnaround in the consumer, and we get a turnaround in the general economy, I don't think raising asset prices is going to do it. And realistically, what this has been all about, it's not necessarily been all about the trillions of dollars that have boosted those asset prices. What's boosted the prices has been the confidence that people have had in the ability of the central bankers to, as I put it, stick the landing. And until this point, you can argue about their motives, you can argue about their methods, but they've stuck the landing. They've maintained that confidence in their own abilities in the market, and that is the crucial ingredient. Now, if you look for the number of articles that are questioning the credibility of the Federal Reserve and of Mario Draghi, and certainly, God forbid, of Kuroda-san in Japan, I mean, his credibility is shot to pieces, as you saw, and again, it's in my presentation, the day he announced the move to negative interest rates. They got the exact opposite outcome to what they would have hoped for. So when you look at the ebbing away of confidence in the central bankers, that's something that no amount of free money is going to be able to counter. If people don't think this is going to have a good outcome, they will react before, or try to react before that outcome occurs. And if we get one of those moves, if we get a mass move to the exits because either it becomes incontrovertible that the US economy is in recession, or just that one marginal person loses faith in central banks, we then run headlong into the problem of massively reduced liquidity in markets, which, as I keep saying, when markets are going up, I can always find you an offer. If you want to buy stock in a rising market, there is a price where you can buy stock. If you get a heavily falling market with the massively reduced liquidity we have, people forget because it's been a number of years, but sometimes the bid is zero. There is no bid, and it happens a lot in falling markets. So you're going to get a lot of people who've all been in the markets for the same reason, which is a central bank backstop. It's not a case of some people like one sector and some people like another sector. It's not a normally functioning market. Everybody is in their trade for the same reason. If you get a change in sentiment, which is all it takes, you get a change in sentiment and people decide, you know what, I want to be on the sidelines, the market cannot absorb that kind of move without gapping lower. You know, every flash crash you've seen is like the trailer when you go to the movies. It's come into a theatre near you, and when they happen in a serious sell-off, they don't flash crash lower and bounce back. They flash crash down there because people who hold ETFs just say, get me out. They hit the sell key at market, and then once the ETFs go on, the basket has to be unwound and people have to hit any bid they can. And people have forgotten this. They're not good times. They're very difficult times to navigate. And so, yes, while I think the central banks absolutely will go back to the playbook and print money and helicopter money and all that, and that may work in the short term. But however increasingly desperate these guys become, eventually it will be seen for what it is, which is desperation. And you tend to do desperate things when stuff is going against you and you've got no choice left. And it's that belief, that recognition on the part of market participants that this is going against these guys and they're floundering around doing anything they can to stop the wheels falling off. It's just that loss of confidence. That's all this is going to take. And it's such an ephemeral thing. You won't see it coming, but when it happens, you'll know it.
One last scenario that I'd like to run by you. We've already got China and Japan, obviously, in big trouble. Europe is already in big trouble with the refugee crisis and, you know, the unsustainable entitlement programs and sovereign debt problems. And it may be, as you've suggested in this interview, that the Brexit event will be the beginning of the end for the European Union. Could this lead to essentially a crack-up boom for the United States, where only because it's the cleanest dirty shirt in a very, very dirty laundry pile, there's just so much flight capital from the rest of the world that the U.S. stock market, the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. Treasury bond market all skyrocket, resulting potentially in a zero yield even on U.S. Treasuries, on the U.S. 10-year? Is that a possibility?
Look, I mean, extraordinarily low rates on the U.S. Treasury are something I don't understand why people have such a hard time. You know, rather, I asked Rao about this in the video you spoke about earlier. I don't see, with bunds negative, JGBs negative, gilts at 500-year lows, I don't understand why people seem to have a problem contemplating the US 10-year at 50 basis points. You know, as Raoul pointed out, it's because people tend to think that we're doing better than everybody else. And they've got that traditional mindset where, you know, the lower your bond yield, the worse your economy is doing. We're not in that world anymore, I'm afraid. We're just not there. And so, you know, I absolutely see that happening. I absolutely see treasuries going lower. I see the dollar going higher. But if and when that happens, I think it'd be naive to assume that the free flow of capital around the world would look like it is today. I mean, capital controls will be instituted very, very quickly if it's clear that that's where this is going. If it's clear in a lot of these countries that we do get another leg up in this dollar bull market and the impact that has across Asia, we've seen a preview of that too, and it's really not very good. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see capital controls put in place to stop those kind of things happening. These are very, very serious problems. These are once in several generational problems that the central bankers and the politicians of the world are facing right now. And they're handling them, I think, very poorly. And I think the measures they've taken, as I said earlier, which have all been reactive rather than proactive, only increase the chances that they make a dreadful mistake if they haven't made it already. And we get a very, very bad outcome here.
I would love to continue this conversation for another hour if we could, but unfortunately we are running out of time. Grant, you produce a fantastic and wildly popular newsletter called Things That Make You Go Hmm. Tell our listeners a little bit about it, where they can find out more information.
Sure. If you go to the website, ttmygh.com, it's thingsthatmakeyougohmm.com. I publish it twice a month, and it's just a look at the world as I see it and the things that I find interesting and I think people should be focusing on. I try and inject a little levity in what is a rather worrying situation. But, you know, there's always opportunity out there. It's just a case of trying to find it. And so, you know, if anyone wants to email me, I will tell them more. Just email me at gw@ttmygh.com.
And you are also the co-founder of Real Vision Television, and all of our regular listeners know that both Aaron and I are your biggest fans. We're very pleased to be able to rebroadcast some of your oldies but goodies, your classics from many months ago, every other Sunday on our own feed. And we've been offering our listeners a free trial, which when we first began offering it was something special that you were not offering to the public. These days you're giving that to the public, so our free trial is not all that special anymore. Can we sweeten the deal a little bit?
Well, due to you twisting my arm, Eric, and the fantastic support you've given us, more importantly, we'd be happy to offer any of your subscribers a 10% discount if they do. And I would urge them to take the free trial. There's nothing to lose. And there's some fantastic material. And if you do decide to subscribe, we'll give your guys a 10% discount if they use the discount code Macro Voices when they sign up.
Fantastic. So as our listeners already know, you can go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices to get the free trial. And then just use the Macro Voices discount code if you decide to purchase a subscription, and you get a 10% discount. Thank you so much for sweetening the deal that way. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your coming back on. We really appreciate this interview. And Aaron Chan will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Eric, that was a great interview with Grant. Let's get straight to the questions. Looking at the market action, especially in the US and UK markets, they appear to indicate that Brexit isn't the end of the world. You know, but the knock-on effects that Grant described are definitely real and to be considered seriously. So if the markets got Brexit wrong, why couldn't they be wrong this time around?
Well, I don't think that it's so much that the market has decided it's not the end of the world. I think the market has decided that it is a big deal and that central banks are going to respond with more accommodation and money printing. And more easy money is coming, and it's going to find its way into asset markets, which is what has been happening. Now, as we discussed with Grant, there comes a point at some point where central banks lose credibility and this system stops working. We're not there yet. And to summarize what Grant said, I think it's when you get to the point where this actually is leading to a collapse of the European Union, if that actually comes to play out, that's when central banks lose credibility and all of a sudden all the central bank accommodation in the world won't save the day. We're not there yet. We're still at a point where if central banks are going to conjure money out of thin air, that money's going to go into asset markets and people know it.
So speaking of losing credibility, do you think the markets have taken back control from the world central banks?
Well, they haven't yet, but I think that this is really the big question that we have to ponder is what does it take? And one of the things that I've said is if we get to the point where inflation starts to spin out of control, and it's not on the horizon right now, it seems like all of these are deflationary forces. At some point, if you get to an inflationary impulse in the economy, then the central banks hands are tied because in order to arrest the inflation, they can't ease anymore. They have to tighten in order to contain runaway inflation. We're nowhere close to that. We've got deflationary pressure, plenty of room for them to continue to print more money. The question is, at some point, if there is a loss of faith in the European Union and we see the EU falling apart, if there is a contagion. And I'll go back to the fall of the Soviet Union. One of the things I remember hearing reported on television, it was a live TV report, and some expert they were interviewing was saying there's absolutely no way that the Berlin Wall would physically be taken down in the next 5 years because these things have to be negotiated. And as he was speaking, they were filming people physically breaking the wall down because the thing suddenly hit a point, a tipping point, where the masses just took over. I think all it takes is an elitist like this guy who penned the article about how the elites have to rise up to confront the mass of ignorance. That attitude problem gets out and people start reacting to it. You could see a major reaction that causes a complete collapse in financial markets. But we're nowhere close to that yet, Aaron. What we've got is a non-binding referendum that says the will of the people in Great Britain is for the government, and that probably means the next prime minister who won't take office for many months, to deliver a message to the European Union that begins a two-year-long negotiation about exiting. It is not something that happens overnight. It could spiral out of control, but that hasn't happened yet.
So Grant talked about a loss in liquidity during falling markets and not being able to catch a bid. So Eric, practically speaking, how can you profit on the downside while still mitigating against a loss in liquidity?
I think the answer to that question, particularly with Grant's comments about liquidity, is to focus on very liquid markets. In other words, if you've got a portfolio that is full of a bunch of individual stocks where liquidity could dry up very easily, you might be better to get out of that and be exposed, if you want to be exposed to equities at all, through an index fund where there's going to be more liquidity. Currencies tend to have more liquidity than equities. There's almost always some kind of bid in currency markets. So I think you have to look to more liquid assets and particularly staying away from thinly traded issues.
So that was a great interview with Grant. He's a fantastic guest. Speaking of fantastic guests, we got several more emails requesting this week to get Hayman Capital founder Kyle Bass on the show.
Well, you know, we'd like that too, folks. We do get a lot of emails requesting Kyle. We also get requests for Stan Druckenmiller. Another name that I would love to get on the show is Neil Howe, the author of The Fourth Turning, which, of course, is all about Kondratiev Winter that Grant and I spoke about today. These are all people we've reached out to who have ignored us. And you have to understand that there's hundreds of financial podcasts on the internet now. There are literally high school students that are making their own financial podcasts, and nobody's ever heard of us. So until we get a little bit more name recognition, we can't get these names. I thought about this before we launched this, and I have a very conscious plan. The reason we ask you when you register at macrovoices.com whether or not you're an accredited investor is I know the people that we want most to get on the program who are going to give us the best interviews are not the salesmen from the sell side, but the fund managers like Kyle Bass, like Stan Druckenmiller. The only way we're ever going to get these big names is if we can say to them, hey, we've got a listener base that's professional finance, sophisticated investors. We've got a large number of accredited investors who are eligible to invest in your fund, Kyle, who are going to be listening. This is worth your time. That's the reason we ask that question when you register. But the thing is, our download statistics tell us that for every regular listener we have to this program, only about 1 in 10 of you has registered at macrovoices.com. Until we get more registrations and a bigger listener base, it's really hard to reach out to these high-profile names and get a response from them. If anybody in the audience knows Kyle Bass personally and has his ear, please tell him Macro Voices is not another high school student running a podcast in his spare time and that we're worth his time. We would absolutely love to get Kyle Bass and a lot of these other names. What we need from you, though, as listeners, we're not asking you for money. We're not going to try to sell you anything, but we do need your help in the sense that we need you to register it, particularly if you're an accredited investor, so that we can increase that statistic, which is how we sell ourselves to people like Kyle Bass when we're reaching out to his handlers, trying to get him to agree to an interview. And certainly, if you have connections, if there are people listening that are connected to these big names, if anybody knows Kyle Bass, knows Stan Druckenmiller, or knows Neil Howe for that matter, please speak to them and tell them that it's worth their time. We've been trying to get a hold of them, but we can't do it without your help. And when you do register, you'll get our free research roundup email. If you don't want it for some reason, it has a safe unsubscribe link. You only have to click it once and you'll never get it again. But for people who do want it, Aaron, tell them what's in this week's roundup.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. So this week we're highlighting the research roundup with Grant Williams and Raoul Paul's Brexit follow-up conversation. Now, I highly recommend it, and I always come away learning something when I listen to Grant and Raoul. And from our listeners, we're excited to bring the latest article from former Swedish hedge fund manager Mikael Siding, who shares his thoughts on Brexit and how he's allocating going forward. You can follow Mikael on Twitter at turemasing. I probably butchered that, but I apologize. It's turemasing. And Mikhail has been a great supporter of Macro Voices, and we also encourage other subscribers to share their writing with our community through future Research Roundup newsletters. Finally, we've got a lot of good stuff, including a recent article detailing the growing OOTT community on Twitter, including our very own Samir Madani, who you can follow on Twitter at Samir_Madani. That's Samir_Madani. So moving on to next week's show, the United States will be celebrating the Independence Day holiday on Monday. So although next Thursday isn't actually a holiday, our audio engineer Chris Kern will be speaking at a podcast conference in Chicago, so we won't be able to bring you our regular show format next week. But we've got something special planned for you instead. Eric, please tell our listeners what's coming up next week.
Well, we won't be able to do our regular feature interview show, so I've been working for a while now on a project we call Accredited Investor Academy. This is a four-part series. For those of you who are high net worth individuals and particularly entrepreneurs running a business who are expecting to come into wealth in coming years, and you're going to need to navigate the world of alternative investments, things like hedge funds and private equity partnerships, private placements, angel investing, all of these topics are things that when I retired from being a software entrepreneur and tried to learn about, I just found there wasn't much information other than what the people selling this stuff were pushing. And frankly, they don't always tell the truth. So for those of you who fit into that demographic, the show we've got next week for you is a preview of the first episode in this four-part series called Accredited Investor Academy. For those of you who are finance professionals that know all about hedge funds and private equity limited partnerships and so on and so forth, maybe that next week's show is not going to be worth your time because, frankly, we're not able to cover current market action or interview a feature guest. It's going to be just Aaron interviewing me about the subject, particularly next week, of private banking and also introducing the other topics that we'll be covering later in the series.
Great. Thanks, Eric, and I'm looking forward to a conversation next week. So that does it for us this week. A big thanks to Grant Williams for joining us on Macro Voices, and I encourage our listeners to at least experience Real Vision Television with a 7-day trial. Now, if you like what you see and choose to subscribe, don't forget to use the Macro Voices discount code to get 10% off of your subscription. That's Macro Voices, one word. We also greatly appreciate the retweets and favorites on Twitter. Ultimately, the more people we reach and the more subscribers and followers we have, the better our chances of bringing you the guests you want. So please continue to share this podcast with friends and family through Twitter, email, or word of mouth. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter at MacroVoices. You can follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric with a K, and myself at underscore Aaron Chan underscore. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. See you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.